Good morning. This is Hugh LaFollette. Welcome to Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Arthur Brooks, professor of public administration and economics at Georgia State University. And our topic is misgivings about government support for arts and humanities. Arthur, glad to have you on the show.
Hi, Hugh. It's good to be here.
All right, if we're going to talk about your views concerning the support, government support for arts and humanities, probably be helpful to begin by just getting an idea about the ways and extent to which government does support the arts and humanities.
Sure, I'd be happy to do so. I can give the idea of how much and to what the government is giving to the arts in kind of a nutshell like this. In the fiscal year 2000, the year that we just finished, we had a number of different mechanisms through which the government funded the arts. One was the federal government, and others were state and local governments. The National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities are the two large federal agencies that give the bulk of the support to the arts and humanities, of course. And their budgets were each around $100 million. Specifically, the National Endowment for the Arts is about $98 million. The National Endowment for the Humanities was a little higher at $115 million. The states give a little bit more. If you take all of the arts councils for all 50 states and add them together, it's a little over $300 million a year currently, or it was last year. And then the counties and municipalities also have arts agencies. And their budgets all added together was a little bit over $200 million in the year 2000. So all told, it was a bit over $600 million that government at all levels gave in direct subsidies to the arts, which is to say direct transfers to arts programs in the United States last year. Well, that's not the only way that the government can give money to the arts. In the United States, most contributions to nonprofit arts organizations are tax deductible. And what that means, in essence, is that the tax deductible part of a contribution is paid by the government. The part that you don't pay in taxes, the government picks up, which for most arts patrons, most people who give donations to arts organizations is somewhere in the neighborhood of 28%. So 28 cents on the dollar that somebody gives to the arts is actually paid by the government. When you add all that up, it turns out to be something between 3 and 5 times higher than the direct money that the government gives to the arts. So as it turns out, it looks like we don't give that much money per capita to the arts, but in real terms, with respect to the way that the government, what the government's giving up in tax revenues, we're actually quite generous at the public level to the arts. There are other ways, of course, that the arts are funded as well. Most prominently in the United States, private philanthropy, private donations directly make up the largest part of arts support, that which is not earned through box office revenues and the like. That last year amounted to $11.1 billion, or between 17 and 18 times higher than the direct government funding to the arts.
When we talk about the size of the government contribution, and we'll even take the larger figure, the size, the contribution, federal, state, local, and in foregone taxes, you're still saying even 3 to 5 times that amount, it's
far lower. It's about a quarter.
Okay.
Of private philanthropy. So it's some,
right,
all of it added together, even in the stuff that's foregone in tax revenues, the indirect subsidies,
right,
to the arts, that it all adds up to about $3 billion.
Okay.
That the government gives to the arts.
Just trying to get a sense of how this compares to other things. I mean, do you have an idea of how that would compare in terms of the size of contribution to other things that the governments do?
It's low. The scale of arts funding in the United States at the government level is far, far lower than other countries, for example, but it's also far lower than most things that the government spends its money on. It's a small fraction of what the government spends in social and human welfare provision, you know, the social services, for example. Health and education get a far, far larger subsidy as well. So it's really a drop in the bucket. It's 0.001% of the federal budget each year. It wouldn't be noticed if it were gone. And the only reason it's noticed when it's here is largely an issue of content. It has to do mostly with what they do with the money, such that people take notice of the fact that $98 million for the National Endowment, for example, gets so much press.
Okay. In fact, I want to ask you about that, but let me ask you, you've given the figures for the arts, and I know that's what you know the most about. Mm-hmm. Do you at least have a ballpark estimate, too, of the humanities?
The humanities get a disproportionately larger share at both the federal and state level, and a little bit less at the local level. So I would have to estimate, but I would say that probably all told it's somewhere in the same neighborhood as the arts, somewhere in the neighborhood from government spending, both direct and indirect, around $3 billion a year.
Okay, and so the combination of arts and humanities together, all level of government support, direct and indirect, would still be around $6 billion?
$5 or $6 billion, probably. That's probably about right. These things are also hard to estimate for a couple of different reasons. One is that states get a lot of their money from the federal government, and the local governments get a lot of their money from the state, so it's hard to know what's passing through and what you're counting twice.
Right.
So these are actually liberal estimates. Probably the real numbers are even a little lower than this, because we're doing a little bit of double counting along the way.
All right. Well, now, you made a point a moment ago. I'd like to go back and amplify that you said that the concern seems to be not so much over whether we ought to do it, that at least in terms of the public debate, an awful lot of the public debate has been focused on the content of some of the things that have been supported, particularly in the arts.
Mm-hmm.
Could you elaborate on that, maybe give some examples?
Sure, I'd be happy to. The great irony for a lot of arts proponents these days is that the government, which gives so little, is getting so much bad press. And the reason they've gotten so much bad press is because of a couple of different content disasters stemming from some funding in the late 80s and onward. This led to what a lot of people in the arts refer to as the culture wars. And basically, there were a few low-paid grants from the National Endowment for the Arts to projects that were considered to be highly offensive in content to a lot of people. And there were two most famous examples. One was the Robert Mapplethorpe photography exhibition that had a lot of homoerotic photography. And that was funded, the exhibition, through some of the museums that exhibited it, were funded through the National Endowment for the Arts. Not a lot of money, but some of the money was coming from taxpayers. The other was Andres Serrano, who had done a photograph called Piss Christ, which was a crucifix that was in his own urine. And, you know, these types of things sound almost comical when you talk about them in retrospect, as it turns out. But naturally, they're not to a lot of people, particularly in the second case, a lot of people who are practicing Christians. And these types of things, the offense is compounded by the fact that taxpayers are implicitly being forced to support it through the tax dollars, and there's no decision-making mechanism that reflects what we would consider to be common values or common grounds of decency in this particular process. This led to a congressional mandate on the National Endowment for the Arts and Humanities saying that common standards of decency had to be applied in the future to all grants made by the agencies. And this was in about 1990. Promptly, the National Endowment for the Arts canceled a bunch of grants to performance artists, particularly, that were doing work that was controversial. Well, four of them that became known as the notorious NEA4 sued the National Endowment for the Arts, saying that, you know, you can't take our grants away because you're censoring us. The lawsuit went to Federal District Court, San Francisco, and the grounds were that censorship, the First and Fifth Amendment violations occurred when government agencies censored material even though the government was paying for the material. Now, this is a kind of not very closely akin to most of the arguments that you hear with First Amendment issues. Because generally what we're talking about is private sector activity that's being censored. Well, in this case, it's public sector activity, and the notion is that, or the argument of the plaintiffs in this case, the NEA artists, was that you can't take away our grants. You must pay for our grants without censoring us, even though it's not private sector activity. Well, they were supported in both Federal District Court and when the NEA appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco in 1992, it was upheld by a 2-to-1 margin. Now, the NEA and a bunch of other supporting groups appealed this to the Supreme Court, who found it in 1998 to be absolutely laughable. The idea that you can't have common standards of decency and that taxpayers should be forced to actually pay for something that's not only controversial but completely offensive to the vast majority of the population seemed absurd to 8 of the Supreme Court justices, and it was quickly decided 8-to-1 in favor of the National Endowment for the Arts that they could try to maintain some standards of of societal decency, as they called it. So that was the way that actually worked. And since then, the National Endowment has changed its tune a little bit. It's shied away from more of the controversial material, both because of the law and because of the support of the Supreme Court of that particular law. But since then, there's been kind of a bruising of public opinion toward public support of the arts. Now, the tragedy for public arts proponents, of course, is that a little bit of this controversial stuff is turning public opinion toward against public art for something that's such a small share of the total money to the arts.
Tell you what, maybe, depending on how much time we've got, I wouldn't mind coming back and talking about that some more. But let's turn and look at one of the central problems, it seems, that you have in your writing about government support for the arts and humanities, and that's your worries those contributions can actually hinder private donations to the arts and the humanities. Maybe you could just briefly summarize what your argument is there, and then we can look at it in more detail.
Sure. This is actually somewhat more of it's not a difficult argument, but it's a little bit more of a technical argument, kind of a fiscal argument. A couple of years ago, I was doing some research on the National Endowment for the Arts, and I was noticing that on their webpage, they asserted that National Endowment dollars stimulated private giving to the arts at a rate of something like $11 to 1. In other words, their assertion was that every dollar the National Endowment gave to the arts would stimulate $11 in private giving. And I investigated the claim a little bit more, and it turns out what they meant was that private giving at that time was about 11 times higher than National Endowment money. Now, it's very different to say that private giving is higher than public subsidies. I mean, that's sort of a statement of fact. It's not the same thing as saying that the public donations stimulate the private giving. Most economists think that it's actually the contrary, that people give $11 to 1 at that time, in spite of the fact that the government was granting subsidies. This is something that economists refer to as crowding out, or a displacement effect. And the idea behind it is that when the government grants subsidies to a private sector organization, usually a nonprofit firm, private donors see less of a need for them to contribute. And consequently, some of their funds, some of their philanthropic dollars are displaced. You can measure this when you have data. And I've looked at this in a lot of different parts of the nonprofit sector, particularly in the arts, but all across the sector as well. And it turns out that this idea that there's a leveraging effect of government dollars on private philanthropy is quite false. There is a displacement impact, and it's somewhere between 10 and 50 cents on the dollar. In other words, every dollar that the National Endowment gives to the arts displaces between 10 and 50 cents in private philanthropy. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that National Endowment money is a bad thing on its face. It simply means that you don't get to keep that whole dollar, and you're actually scaring away some of your contributors. That has problems beyond the fiscal issues, of course. One is, what does that mean for long-term giving patterns? And I've been thinking about that a little bit recently, simply because here in Atlanta, everybody seems to be worried about the fact that young people with money aren't giving as much as generations past. And it kind of stands to reason, if in fact there's this crowding out effect in philanthropy in general, in the arts in particular, that people who are, say, 40 years old and younger have grown up in a time where the social welfare and the social safety net is robust in the United States. As a result of that, the fact that there's so much contribution to so much social and human welfare provision, as well as health, education, the arts, and everything else, that there's less incentive to give philanthropically. We won't know for another 50 years if young people today, in fact, are stingy, but there's reason to believe, and it's a pretty reasonable assumption, that people are having their giving patterns altered by these types of government policies. So in the static sense, right now, there's an accounting problem that National Endowment and other government arts agency money creates for arts organizations. They lose money from it. In the long-term sense, they actually might be doing themselves irreparable harm from younger generations who, when they make a lot of money and are older and retired, will be given money because their habits have been squeezed out. Now, of course, there are other arguments as well, things about, you know, we hear a lot these days about social capital, which is to say civic participation and the fact that people aren't participating in civic groups as much as they used to in the past. It's not, I could make a reasonable argument, I think, that government squeezing out people's private philanthropy and private contributions is not going to be especially good for the accumulation of social capital. Part of civic participation, of course, is participation financially in private sector and non-profit civic groups, of course. And the last concern I think that we could have is that when government gets involved in the decision-making, financially speaking, you centralize decision-making in government more. And I think that a lot of Americans are uncomfortable with the idea that instead of people with the money making contributions making the decisions about what gets produced and for whom, that we have unelected officials in government taxing money away from people and making those decisions for them in an area that's not education or health. I mean, this is an area of the arts, which seems fundamentally different to most people, it would seem.
There are a number of different issues here I'd like to pursue in the second half of the show. I'd like to pause up for a moment. I'm speaking today with Arthur Brooks, professor of public administration and economics at Georgia State University, and our topic is misgivings with government support of the arts and the humanities. I guess I don't want to get too much into this. It certainly would get too technical, but when you talk about the studies that show this crowding out effect, could you briefly describe the sorts of things you have in mind? I mean, how would statisticians discern this?
Well, basically, it actually isn't too technical, conceptually speaking. You have data on how much money people give and what people give to. You also have data on what government gives to and how much they give as well. And if you look at this in the aggregate, in other words, if you look at, for example, citizens in the state of Georgia, and you compare the amount that people are giving at a particular time with the amount that government's giving to particular organizations, and you control for a lot of other things like sociodemographics and the year and what the economy is doing, all that kind of stuff, it turns out you can net out a big part of the relationship that you see between what people give and what government gives. If you do it, I mean, there are naturally, you know, sort of the technical issues that go along with doing this type of research, but conceptually it's not very hard to understand that with these types of data you can start to see patterns established. I've dealt a lot with symphony orchestra data, and I've dealt with data on universities and all types of data in the nonprofit sector. And the finding that keeps coming up again and again and again is that a dollar in government spending displaces somewhat less than a dollar in private philanthropy.
Yeah. At some point, I wouldn't mind pursuing the statistical questions further. But
sure.
Let's stay at a bit more general level here.
Okay.
I mean, one of the things that you said a moment ago is that it seems to you, and perhaps seems to most people, that arts and humanities are somehow fundamentally different. And that actually leads into one of my questions I have. I mean, when we talk about the crowding out effect, there's clearly some sorts of cases where it's easy to understand how the crowding out effect happens.
Right.
For instance, I don't make any contributions to building of roads.
Right.
I don't make any contributions to putting up stoplights. I assume the government's going to do that, and since the government's going to do it, there's no need for me to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it might even be true, it's at least partly true of medical care, that, you know, I assume that the government's going to make its contribution and the rest is going to come through me and whatever insurance I buy.
Right.
But certainly with other things like education, it doesn't seem to be true at all. I mean, maybe it is. But I take it that certainly the second largest social program to which the government contributes is education. I assume first is probably health, though that may be a mistake.
Actually, the federal government doesn't contribute very much to education, but government at all levels, of course, the number one is education.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And yet it seems that private philanthropy to education, especially to higher education, is very high.
Right.
What would the difference be? Why would it appear to have a strong crowding out effect on the art, giving to the arts and humanities, but not to education? Or is it simply a misperception?
Well, there are a couple of different issues embedded here. Education is complicated because there are both government educational institutions, especially when we're talking about post-secondary education, talking about universities. They're both private and public universities. And public universities have a really hard time getting philanthropy going, as it turns out. private universities have a much easier time of it, and the argument could be completely consistent with the crowding out idea. It's very plausible that the fact that private universities are not fundamentally reliant on state and federal funding acts as a stimulus on alumni to support the organizations, whereas state universities generally get somewhere in upwards of 75% of their total income from the state, and sometimes as little as 20 to 25% from tuition. That being the case, it looks like there's kind of an endless money pump that's funding these types of organizations, and it becomes less incumbent apparently on alumni to support the organizations. There are some exceptions to this, of course. The University of Texas has a huge endowment, but most state universities don't have anywhere near the magnitude of endowments of even small private universities and colleges. So that's probably consistent. The other question that is raised by all this is there some inherent difference between education and the arts? And when I talk to leaders in the arts, and I was actually made my living in the arts for a very long time, and I wrestled with some of these issues at a practical level. The questions that come up are, can we convince people that the arts are really a Renaissance lifestyle issue? Are the arts like soup kitchens and homeless shelters and universities, or are they fundamentally different? And I think that it sounds almost sophistic for us to make arguments that say that the arts are a public good and integral to our lifestyles in much the same way that welfare for poor people is an issue that is a source of funding that we absolutely have to have for our quality of life. Now, I'm a huge proponent of the arts. I mean, I love the arts, yet I still don't think that most people would buy the argument that we need the arts just as much as we need elementary schools. And that fact, that intuitive fact, I think is what separates out a lot of arts programs for many Americans from many other areas of what we refer to as public goods. And I realize it's not an especially technical argument. And to try to motivate that a little bit more, you can go to historical precedent and see how these types of things were traditionally funded. It turns out that when you look at the history of the nonprofit sector, that you can see a huge break between what upper-class people have given to traditionally and how they've given their money, and what people in the middle and lower classes have given to and how and what patterns they've given their money. And the arts institutions have always and everywhere been characterized by wealthy patrons who give in big-ticket gifts. And that's something that most Americans simply can't relate to, as it turns out. And as a matter of fact, the idea of the performing arts in particular, but the arts in general, the high arts in general, are an experience that most Americans can't relate to. When less than 2% of Americans regularly listen to classical music, yet practically every American consumes education and healthcare and social services, it's hard to make the comparison between the two because most people just don't have it as part of their everyday lifestyle.
Well, certainly one lesson that could be drawn from that is if these organizations like the NEA want support, that maybe they're just doing a very bad job of convincing the American people that it's worthwhile.
Could be, or maybe the American people are quite content to fund the arts lavishly from the private sector. And we do. It turns out that even if you look at indirect subsidies, which are so much higher than direct subsidies, our funding to the arts per capita is not very far from France's. Now, France, of course, has a reputation for spending huge amounts of public subsidies on the arts. If you add in private philanthropy, per American, we lavish far more money on the arts than any of the Western European countries. There's practically no private philanthropy of the arts in Western Europe, incidentally. So I dare say that the way we set up our society and the funding of some of the cultural institutions in our society is such that people are most comfortable funding things through the private sector through philanthropic means. There are polls every year. The Lou Harris Organization, for example, often does a poll about the arts, and they ask sort of the man on the street, would you be willing to give a dollar more to the arts every year through your taxes, or $10 more, whatever? And invariably, somebody will say, okay, I'd be willing to give $5 more to the arts. But it doesn't really tell you anything, because what the question that ought to be asked under those circumstances is, would you be willing to give $5 more in taxes to support different types of social programs? And if you had to make a choice between giving it to vaccinating kids in the inner city or giving it to the Metropolitan Opera, what do you choose? Then it's obvious. So it turns out, you know, people make real choices. And the way they make their choices, you know, where the rubber hits the road for funding of nonprofit institutions in the United States is at the level of philanthropy. People decide or decide not to with their own private dollars. And I think a lot of Americans are very uncomfortable with big bureaucracies making decisions about cultural issues the same way that they might about public education.
All right, we've only got about 3 minutes left here. One other question I want to ask about this crowding out effect is, you mentioned early on, one of the first things you did is you talked about both distinguished direct from indirect support for the arts, and indirect support would be in tax breaks. Do tax breaks have a crowding out effect?
That's not clear, and that's an area that's been somewhat under-researched, I think. There have been some studies, actually quite a number of studies, that talk about the extent to which changing tax rates increases or decreases private charitable giving. I'm just working on one at the moment right now, and the results are kind of provocative for you to answer your question. It turns out that if you can separate out changes in income from changes in the amount that you pay in taxes, increases in taxes, actual level of taxes or tax rates, if you prefer, lead to higher levels of charitable giving. And that makes sense. The reason for that is when you have a higher tax rate, that means that the government, through tax-deductible donations, is paying a bigger part of your donation. So when the government pays a bigger part of your donation and you net out the effects of income, because your income goes down when your tax rate goes up, your effective income, you give more money. And so it makes perfect sense under the circumstances. So we would think that as indirect subsidies go up, this would follow higher tax rates, and higher tax rates lead to more giving at the private level. So if we want to give money from the government and we want to protect private philanthropy, the way to do it is indirectly through the deductions and through the Internal Revenue Code.
So would one way of saying this be that it's the direct contributions that are more likely to crowd out philanthropy, whereas the indirect ones may actually promote it?
Exactly right. I mean, you said it far better than I did. Thanks. The direct subsidies crowd out philanthropy. Indirect subsidies crowd in philanthropy.
Could you give us a 45-minute summary, something you'd like the listener to remember?
Well, sure. I think at the end of the day, when we're talking about anything like policy, it's worthwhile to consider that it's easy to criticize these agencies a lot and talk about the fact that they're doing so many things wrong and so forth and so on. It's more constructive to end on a note that talks about possible solutions to the problem. And there are three possible solutions that would actually address the trouble both with crowding out and with, you know, public outrage about what's been going on in the arts. The first is to zero out the National Endowment for the Arts and the state arts organizations. And that's kind of the most extreme example of an argument that you hear from usually the Republican House. The second is to just block grant it out to local levels so they can take care of local issues more effectively, and you won't have so much outrage from, you know, organizations that are doing things federally funded that don't reflect, you know, local values. The last is for the National Endowment for the Arts to pay more attention to education and to consumers, such that we're not funding artists to do things that we find to be so far out of the mainstream. So I do think that, notwithstanding some of the issues that I've talked about, there are real solutions, and these are the things that we need to examine without just saying the NEA and all other government funding for the arts is bad.
Okay, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
My guest today is Arthur Brooks, professor of public administration and economics at Georgia State University, and our topic is misgivings about government support for arts and humanities. This is Hugh LaFollette, Fridays and Issues. Good day.